and welcome to Something's Off with Andrew Heaton. I'm your host, Dave Barry's bastard son, Hugo Barry. And today I'm going to triumphantly bring back Brian Brushwood to talk with me about the Green New Deal proposed last week. And normally I make a very big effort to have every program make all of us more intelligent than when we came into it. But I think there's a significant possibility that after talking about something that's such a spadgecock, fern-eating, piffle treat, that we will all be slightly dumber. However, we might have fun over the course of it. As a preview, I will tell you a couple of things that I think we could rename the Green New Deal. We could call it the Social Justice Reform Act, which also has solar panels. We could call it the Green Black Hole. Or we could call it the Great Leap Forward something-something wind. All of those more or less encapsulate my thoughts on what we're going to be talking about here in a few minutes with Brian Brushwood, but it should be fun either way. And then afterwards, the first installment of Cooking with Heaton. So stick around for that. But before we get into any of the fun today, we do need to pay the bills, and that means a word to our sponsor. Something's Off with Andrew Heaton is brought to you by Snuffy's off Route 44, a restaurant above and beyond regular diner fare where the waiters and waitresses are on horseback. This week, in celebration for Valentine's Day, mention Something's Off and get a free plate of deep-fried chocolate-covered oysters. They're delicious and romantic. And why not wash that down with a cocktail? My favorite is the Kimberwick, which is the Snuffy's original, consisting of rum and Ovaltine. Now, I know you guys are excited about Snuffy's. I am too. And I know you're excited about the Valentine's Day promotions that are going on this week. They have a string quartet all this week, where all of the musicians are mounted on horseback. That's pretty cool, right? And it's emblematic of what Snuffy's is, which is a restaurant that's just a normal diner, except that the staff rides horses. I have explained this many times on this program. Your horses are in no way involved at Snuffy's. It's a regular diner. The waiters and waitresses are on horseback. This week, there are also musicians on horseback. That's the extent of the horses. So noting that, and noting that I have clarified this multiple times, don't bring your horse to Snuffy's this week for a horse date. I don't even know what a horse date is, and frankly, I don't think that's a part of any type of actual breeding program. I don't see why it would be. But apparently, last night, three or four of you brought your horses to Snuffy's in an attempt to introduce them to other horses romantically for breeding purposes, which is weird and frankly inefficient and very, very bizarre way of handling things. Also, it's not very hygienic, and it's very disturbing if I'm eating at Snuffy's, I'm just having a plate of corned beef hash, and all of a sudden, a brood mare and a stud start mating inside of a diner. I don't know if you've ever been around mating horses before. It is not something that you want near your food. And that is not something that the Snuffy's staff would be doing, but some wires got crossed and you guys misinterpreted what's going on. So again, Snuffy's, wonderful diner, great specials this week. Don't bring your horses. Definitely do not try and breed your horses inside of Snuffy's for Valentine's Day. Don't do that. Okay. Thank you. Finally, they've told me that they're doing a promotion this week as well. If you will call in and leave a verbal review of your dining experience at Snuffy's, I am going to pick one of those messages on the program. I will play it, and you can get a free meal at Snuffy's. Their number is 844-SNUFFY's. That's 844-768-3397. Leave a message detailing how much you enjoyed their service and food, and I will pick one this week, play it. You'll get a free meal at Snuffy's. Snuffy's off Route 44, because everything tastes better from a horse. My guest today is Brian Brushwood. He eats fire for a living. Hello, Brian.
Oh, my gosh. You finally did it. You thought you could throw me a curveball again, hitting me with all this international foreign policy. Guess what? You brought me on for showbiz. And that's
right.
What we got this week. This is straight up showbiz.
We do, because the Green New Deal is not actually any attempt at problem solving. It's just posturing. It's very intense posturing.
Yeah, the moment I read the words non-binding, you know, that's usually when we dedicate the third Thursday of the fifth month to Snuffy's or something.
Yeah.
You know, it's like whatever.
This is how bad this was. So I asked my new producer Jennings. I said I'm bringing on Brian Brushwood tomorrow, and we're going to just hate on the Green New Deal. But I do feel that it's incumbent upon me to represent it as best I can. That way, we're not just doing alley-oops. That way, there's some actual good policy discussion here. And I said, can you please steel man this for me, do some research, and present the best possible explanation for this? And he got a nosebleed, and that's the extent of how much we've been able to do it.
I'll do my best to represent it as charitably as possible.
Yeah.
In the election cycle, it seems like if there's ever going to be a moment, we all know that it would appear to my untrained eyes that as long as a Democrat shows up and is civil and has moderate policies and is somebody that a few Republicans could, you know, the Never Trumper crowd could be seduced by, then that's who's going to win. So in the meantime, if you want to make political hay, if you want to help ensure or basically get a litmus test of just how far to the left, how progressive America's taste for politics could be, this seems like a fine way to do it.
This is a good manifesto for taking a litmus test of not environmentalism, but rather every single progressive wish list you can possibly think of.
Exactly. Well, and plus, now here's the other thing. I it's a cynical take on it, and I don't like it because I don't like our politics. I don't like the way Trump has run politics of division. But this is the same move. This is the left's wall. This is something that they know is just going to drive the right crazy, and they're going to revel in it. This is their Roger Stone moment where they're just giddy to get a rise out of all those red hat wearing suckers.
I think you're right, because I was reading through. So for folks that are unfamiliar with the Green New Deal, we're going to break it down in a minute. But just to give you a quick a tag of what we're talking about, or the new Green Deal had kind of been in an amorphous state for a while, where it was just sort of Democrats would say, we need a new Green Deal, or we need a Green New Deal. And that kind of was given a blueprint last week by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. So she wrote a non-binding resolution that kind of spelled it out. And then for a few minutes, she had an FAQ section on her website that has been suspiciously taken down. And I went through both. I read both. And I'm with you, Brian, because I read the FAQ and I was like, this has to be trolling me. This can't be. This can't be. And the part that I thought was just outright trolling was it had the phrase, we will guarantee, I think, a livable wage for everyone.
A job.
Including people who cannot or will not work.
And I went, who are unable or unwilling to work.
That's right. Unable or unwilling to work. And I went, there's no way. That's got to be designed. That's got to be media catnip, I think. Which is, by the way, I think that the longer I watch Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who I might ultimately do a moratorium on because I don't want to play into her hand in the same way that I don't want to play into Trump's hand, is I think she's actually very similar to Donald Trump in a sort of
Absolutely.
Temperamental sense as a politician. Donald Trump is... To put it charitably, he is a policy illiterate. He is not sitting down and reading white papers. No one is accusing Donald Trump of going to Cato or the New America Institute and asking to read dense policy jargon. Neither is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. However, both of them are brilliant at being able to command the media cycle. And I think that that's what she's doing and doing very well, where none of this stuff is going to happen. And none of it even really would... I mean, even if you could get it through, I don't think it would accomplish very much other than obliterating the global economy. But that's not the point of it. The point of it is to get media attention. And I think this is her deeper goal, is to shift the Overton window. The idea is to grab the reins of this particular conversational topic that people that are kind of on the fringes are like, oh, that's crazy. But we could, you know, we could reforest Montana. And then that kind of begins this dynamic shift, which is very clever. And she's winning at that so far.
Well, so before we get into the details of the insane stuff that's in the bill, I do just want to reiterate, like, I suspect that to some degree you and I are part of the problem and that we're exactly playing into her hands right now.
Yeah, which is why, again,
I might actually do a moratorium
on her at some point. I might go, nope, can't. I'm not going to build this up anymore. But for right now, it's kind of fun to play with.
Yeah, and you're right, and so is Trump for a while, and then all of a sudden it wasn't. It's like I'm tired of the divisive rhetoric.
The polls were made, you know, consistent. You went, oh, wait a minute, because I initially thought Trump was going to be Herman Cain of 2016. I thought this is going to be great. He's going to have like a week. It's going to be a lot of fun. We're all going to buy hats. They're going to be funny and ironic, and then it just kept going.
Yeah, and again, like, what's funny is if I picture AOC and Trump going head to head, I'm sad. Not for the people, but for the universal acceptance across the United States of, like, this is how politics should be from now on.
Yeah.
Nothing of substance, nothing of compromise, nothing of getting anything productive done, but instead a game of cut down artistry to be played out, and you know, we clap with our votes, which to me would be a real travesty.
I think clap with our votes is a very good synopsis for that. Both of them are social media accounts who moonlight as politicians. And were you to watch them in a debate, in addition to, I would never advise anyone to watch the two of them go in a debate without having at least four fingers of scotch beforehand. But I would think that would not result in any great, no one's going to walk away from that going, I should read Milton. That really would be an insightful way to think about the, that's not going to happen. It would be a lot of posturing of, I am the righteous and I am defending the American people from degenerates. And they're all kind of screaming at each other. And I got to say, it's so frustrating for me looking at this kind of stuff because I view politics as an exercise in problem solving. Generally, right. My problem solving is generally going to identify politics as the problem about 90% of the time. But I'm willing to sit down and go, okay, what is the issue we're trying to resolve? What's the best way to do this? And if you're beginning with the presumption of I am a morally certain commander of the army of righteousness fighting against the platoon of evil, that we're no longer in the problem-solving matrix at this point.
Correct. Well, and one last thing before we dive into the details, I would encourage anybody, you know, we're going to talk about this and it's just going to, you know, it's laughable. But then again, so is Trump's plan for the wall laughable. But to be charitable on both sides, you know, the idea of the wall was an aspirational goal to be for something, to be for border security, to put America first, to take care of our own before we go messing with the rest of the world. That's the most charitable version of the wall I could come up with. And likewise, the most charitable version of this is we on the left want to be for something and damned if we aren't going to call our moonshot, whether we get there or not. How about you guys? Are you with it? Are you for this thing for us?
Yeah. And I think therein lies probably the best steel man argument for this, because I do, like, at some point I don't tend to bring people on to fight with them. There are some things that I want to do in the future where I'd love to have somebody on to talk about inequality. I get a lot of feedback on that, Brian, where people say, they're kind of curious because I'm very anti-poverty. I don't really care about inequality. Whereas my progressive friends see them as intrinsically linked, and they also see inequality as just sort of an inherent evil. I need to bring somebody on to talk about that.
You know, it's interesting because I don't see it as an inherent evil, but I'm increasingly aware of it as an inherent liability.
Like, yeah, it does have an emotional element to it. Because I view it as a psychological phenomenon, but psychological phenomena can still topple the table. They can still bring about revolts.
Yes.
And then I'd say, like, and then probably in April, I might peg it to Earth Day or something else, but I do want to dive more into the environmental side of this. I think we're more likely, I think, Brian, you and I are probably going to be more likely on the policy end of this today. I do want to go into environmental stuff in April, and I plan to. I'm going to bring on somebody from the Niskanen Center and talk about free market solutions to climate change. And then I'll probably bring on somebody that I would describe as a climate skeptic, because I want to represent all those views. And that's where I think the best steelman argument I can come up with for the Green New Deal is we are on the verge of the apocalypse. Math is secondary to doing something to swerve away from this massive global train wreck. And thus we have to jump over minor squabbles and truly energize the entire country in order to stop the apocalypse from happening. I think that's the most charitable thing I can give it. My problem with it is, having read through the bill or the resolution, having read through the FAQ section, whoever wrote that has such a abysmal understanding of economics and policy that I cannot fathom they would be very good at the environment either. And they don't appear to have a really good grasp of environmentalism on top of that when you get into the details. So I kind of look at that and I'm like, okay, if we do need to mobilize the whole country, you are not the person to lead the charge.
Yeah, well, and what's funny is it reminds me of the early days of the Trump campaign when you saw the design choices where it's clear that somebody just opened up word art and just threw some words on there.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, that's bad leadership to let this poor quality of graphics go out. I'd say it's bad leadership to let this poorly written thing be the rallying cry for everyone.
Did you get a chance to read through the FAQ? Because that was just a masterful document before it was taken down.
No, I unfortunately, I only, to me, I showed up after that party, so I only heard the legends. It's like I showed up, there was a fist fight at the party, and they're like, oh, bro, you missed it. You should have seen the insane stuff in this FAQ.
It was great. So, and I'll say it was okay, so the FAQ section is basically this. It is climate change is happening, and it's catastrophic. America has inequality and poverty. The solution is to combine the New Deal with environmentalism. Now, have an intern write that up on his or her lunch break. And that's the key bit. And I'm not convinced that didn't happen with the resolution either, although probably Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez wrote that. The FAQ section, like that's where we get the line about people who are unable or unwilling to work. There was also a line in there where I went, have you, wait, what? Like where the, there was one about farting cows was literally, it entered the equation. Yeah, cow farts. Like we won't be able to stop cow farts within 10 years. And I was like, did you just put cow farts in your FAQ for this? Like it's, that is a thing. Like methane coming out from cows is a factor in carbon emissions. Like that's legitimate. But just the way you phrased it, cow farts, really? This is how you're going to do this? Which again makes me wonder if it's not media catnip. If it wasn't designed for people like me to like start writing think pieces about it and give it a lot of coverage.
Oh my God, she really is the Trump of the left. Yeah. I mean, like she wants everybody to go nuts over her language use.
Although she did take it down though, which is the bit that I like. And then there were some like just blatant errors in it. Like So one of the introductory FAQ sections says, when JFK said we'd go to the. Excuse me, I'm going to read this verbatim. When JFK said we'd go to the by the end of the decade, people said impossible. And you look at that and you're
what?
Like, well,
No.
You probably meant moon, but the word moon was left out. So it's reading it, I'm adding it. When JFK said we go to the moon insertion, by the end of the decade, people said impossible. If Eisenhower wanted to build the interstate highway system today, people would ask how we'd pay for it. When FDR called on America to build 185,000 planes to fight World War II, every business leader, CEO, and general laughed at him. I read that. I was like, okay.
I don't think anybody was laughing after Pearl Harbor.
Yeah. I see. There's my thing. I'm like, did you Google any of this? Did you read any of it? Like what? Okay. With the moon thing, I am routinely accused by libertarians of being a moon Nazi because of my ongoing support of NASA and the moon program. But the argument against NASA and the moon program during the Kennedy administration wasn't that we couldn't do it. It was that it was a giant waste of money that didn't accomplish anything designed to distract us from Vietnam, which is a pretty good critique of the moon program. But that's where the actual firepower is coming from. With the highway system, I read that and I was like, because in a minute she's going to go, or they're going to go into this massive thing about high-speed trains, and that tends to be a bugaboo of progressives, is, we wish we were more like Europe, because I went there one time on spring break, and I deep down am French, and they have trains, and I wish we had trains. The reason we don't have trains is because of Eisenhower, because he built this massive highway system that took a ton of money, and then it created this infrastructure network, but it made it prohibitively expensive to ever have a train again in America because it's cheaper to just drive yourself anywhere. And then the FDR, they laughed at him with I don't think that happened. I don't think a bunch of business people did that, just laughed at the president. But again, there was that moon omission that was left out. There was also like a note at the top of it in the FAQ section that had we need to lead the charge on this, and then it was in parentheses. We need to leave the charge of this or somebody else is going to take it from us or something like that. And I was like, are you leaving notes to self in your FAQ section? Like, it makes me wonder if maybe the document was meant to be internal and then they accidentally posted it on the website and went, oh, whoops.
So do you think here's what I suspect at some level is this was written up and meant to be kind of just a little stunt. But then all of a sudden, a whole bunch of people started, you know, publicly throwing their weight behind it. Spotlight got shown on it, and all of a sudden you realize, oh, this is not ready for prime time. Quick, let's get rid of all this. Let's clean up that language. And then, like, they put out a statement saying, to be clear, the only thing we're all signing up on is this final version that's up now. Just forget you saw anything else.
Yeah, just to clarify, all we're doing is posturing. No one's actually proposing any solutions to problems. All we're doing is establishing our moral base so that we can get votes when we run for president, which I think, like, it's of the 180 Democrats that are proposed or have declared their candidacy for president in the next election, I think like 20 of them have already signed on to this. And it was, you can see the contrast between, say, Cory Booker and Elizabeth Warren against Nancy Pelosi, I have many thoughts on Nancy Pelosi, but I did like her more as a result of this whole thing because she's so clearly the adult in the room compared to most of the other. She's not running for president, so she doesn't have to claim that she loves this. And she was kind of dismissive of it on a variety of levels.
Yeah, when she referred to it as the green dream thing or whatever.
Yeah, the green dream thing or whatever. Yeah, and I was like, ah, good. Thanks, Nancy. Yes, there's someone's being an adult today in the Democratic National Party. And then on top of that, the other kind of tell of this not being a high priority for her is that she's created a climate change committee and not invited Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez onto it. Which means that in Nancy Pelosi's mind, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is not a part of her preferred solutions dealing with climate change.
Well, and keep in mind, again, nobody should get in any kind of panic over this because even if this passes, it literally means nothing. It's just basically a high five count. But it's as though they went to work in the writer's room thinking, all right, what's one more thing that we can add that'll almost certainly make sure nobody will like the whole thing?
Right.
And like, I'm looking at this list, guaranteeing a job with a family sustaining wage, adequate family medical leave, paid vacations, and retirement security to all people of the United States.
Yep.
You can't get fired and you get a retirement. Yeah, that sounds great. Throw ice cream for all in there.
Yeah, it's literally basically if you gave... If you gave Bernie Sanders some Adderall and a couple of martinis and just went, you have to write things down you want for the next 45 minutes. That's the underlying. And then at the end of it, they're like, also wind and solar. It's very clear that the environmental stuff's kind of a secondary backdrop to the, yes, we get to mobilize the economy as socialists.
But plus it's counterfactual to itself because two lines below that it says, you know, because now we all have guaranteed jobs from which we cannot be fired and we'll get a good retirement. But we also will provide resources, training and high quality education, including higher education, to all people of the United States. Why would I do any of that? I already have a guaranteed job and infinite retirement for me and my family with vacation.
Well, you have a guaranteed job or not job. You could take your pick of working or not working, and you get vacation. Yeah, you've got all of those things. You've got single payer healthcare thrown in. You've got union deals are factored in that we're going to try and, or it's going to incorporate unions into everything. It's going to have a very high emphasis on family farming, which. Incidentally, like this is a weird counterintuitive part of environmentalism, which I'm going to throw in my obligatory Thomas Sowell quote here. Environmentalism is not, or rather environmental policy is not about solutions, it's about trade-offs, because that's ultimately what we're talking about. If you're going to build a windmill or a wind turbine, you also have to factor in, okay, are we going to have to get heavy metals to build this thing? Are we going to have to take land away? Like all of that stuff. One of the things, the focus on family farms tend to have a higher carbon footprint than large-scale industrial farms do. Because if you're a family farm, you've got one truck, and you're making that one truck back and forth between your farm and the farmer's market. Whereas if you've got a large farm, you've got a massive semi-truck that's able to do that stuff. So weirdly, in the same way that, you know, buses have less of a carbon footprint than a Buick for one family, it's kind of the same thing where there's stuff built in there where it's like, that? Wait, what? Where did you?
Yeah.
Or like it, I love trees. I'm at the end of the year, I might like I've dedicated, Brian, I've promised to donate $1 to charity this year for every snarky or political tweet I make. And I stand by that, by the way. If everyone in America did that, we would take care of so many problems. If you build everyone $1 for every snarky political tweet they made, I might literally take it to buy trees at the end of the year. But that said, the amount of trees that you'd need to reforest in order to actually absorb the carbon of the United States would require completely reforesting all 50 states. So it's not a viable. It's kind of like it's a nice thing, but it's not a viable thing. There's no actual good meaty environmental policy behind it.
I mean, we should be thinking more of the, you know, those outlier science-minded engineering feats, like you know, the most efficient way to capture carbon is I believe algae. You know, we can go out and create a giant bloom in the middle of the ocean that would do a lot more absorption. Also, you know, we have more trees now than we did 150, 200 years ago. We have a lot of trees.
Yeah.
But the plus also that romanticized vision of the family farm. I don't understand why people are so in love with the idea of the family farm. partly because, number one, people who have family farms have been moving to the city as fast as they can. So that tells you that given the choice, a lot of people would rather live in cities. Number two, when we picture, oh, can there be anything more environmental than to be self-sufficient on your own farm? We have a word for that. That's called subsistence farming, and it's indicative of abject poverty.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of it in third world countries.
Yeah. There were a number of those things. Oh, and by the way, I want to put out one more thing that I think we left off of the grab bag of Bernie Sanders' Viking and fever dreams. Since no American should be left out of the heat, out in the heat, the Green New Deal calls for the federal government to provide all people of the United States with affordable, safe, and adequate housing, which I like. Cost alone, that terrifies me. I can't imagine a worse way to create abject hovels of slum poverty than having the federal government allot housing to everyone. Oh, God.
What's funny is the word that scares me the most is the government deciding what is adequate.
Yes.
Like, that's the one.
Oh, this just sounds great. Yeah, that kind of gets to that root thing where there are certain I'm much more amenable to arguments of sort of social democrat welfare programs of we're going to give people checks for this. When you nationalize stuff, I'm like, oh, you're just going to kill a ton of folks. Like, you want to nationalize agriculture, you want to nationalize housing, ugh.
Well, we've actually seen examples of that. Tim Blair wrote an opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal where he talks about a small-scale version of exactly what they're promising. But instead of houses, the Australian government just wanted to give everybody insulation in their house. It's like, hey, man, it's safe. You'll use less AC and all that stuff. So they said they would give up to $1,600 per family to if you lived in your house, to have it properly insulated up there. And of course, as you can imagine, everybody just all of a sudden got in that business. All the bids, guess what, came out to the maximum $1,600.
Yeah.
Nobody was qualified. And the thing that tipped off that was at the Daily Telegraph, somebody called to order a pizza, and the guy who answered the phone and took the pizza order asked them if they wanted a quote on insulation. And so as a result, 100 houses caught fire. The environment minister Peter Garrett, who used to be lead singer of Midnight Oil and sang 1987's nice. Beds Are Burning, announced the plan
politics.
was suspended. So, like, people were taking using as quote insulation just like wood paper pulp. So the whole things were tinder boxes. It's awful. People died because of it, because of heat stroke and stuff. So it's one thing to say, hey, we want the government to provide this, but the vehicle by which they do it is by shoveling money. And when that happens, you do not attract the best and the brightest.
Mm.
You attract the fastest and the scammiest.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. And it goes to kind of my deeper position on any policy you're wanting to formulate. You should have a negative proof that's available there where you're saying we want to cause X to happen. This is the metric by which we would judge it. If this does not happen, the bill is a failure. Like, that should be just in everything. That's applying the scientific theory to politics, which allegedly everybody's very pro science. Well, there's a way to do it right there. You shouldn't have something that's you can't disprove.
I'll tell you who's not pro-science is the people who made sure to not write the word nuclear anywhere in this plan to get
yes.
off of all fossil fuels
See,
in the next 10 years. That's insane.
That's another thing, too. And this is where I'll get more in-depth on this in a future episode. So to kind of disclose where I'm at and why I'm additionally frustrated about all of this, I do think climate change is happening. I think that mankind is playing a role in it. And I think there's a role for government in it, which would not put me in the, you know, extreme no government intervention ever camp. It would put me in the global warming's happening, let's fix it camp. And I spend a decent amount of time talking to my libertarian and conservative friends when this issue comes up, assuring them, no, this isn't a conspiracy to take over the economy. That's just conspiracy talk. This is, you know, this is a scientific conversation. It's not just an excuse to socialize everything. And then this comes out. And I'm like, okay, so this is clearly an excuse to socialize everything. And you are really not making my job any easier of trying to inject some climate change stuff into the conversation. Because if I were a conservative Republican, I would look at this and go, right, this is a confirmation of every theory I've had over the last 30 years that it's all just a big excuse to give technocrats and socialists control of the economy. And
which makes me feel even more like this is just, that's exactly what they want. That has to be what she wants by putting this out. She's the Trump of the left.
Yeah. She wants to stoke that. Yeah. And with the nuclear thing, this is where I wish that Republicans and libertarians would sit down at the table and talk about climate change and what we can do about it, because that's one of those things where I think conservatives and libertarians would have a great argument of going, you guys aren't actually serious about this, because this is the cheapest way and fastest way to make clean energy that we have available to us with current technology. You would absolutely 100% have to use it if you were going to do what the Green New Deal proposes, which is get rid of all fossil fuels within 10 years. If you're going to get rid of all fossil fuels within 10 years, you have to have an abundant source of energy. And there's no way solar panels or wind could take up the slack. I don't think we could even make, like, even if you had the money to build them, I'm not sure that we'd have the capacity to build that money. You could put up nuclear power plants. And that's been this weird sticking point with progressives over the last 30, 40 years, where because electricity from nuclear power is evil, and it's sinful power. It's TRAFE. That you put in your house, we should never build nuclear power plants. And in reality, we basically had one blowout from a nuclear power plant, which happened in Soviet Russia, which I think is more indicative of Soviet Russia than us. We haven't had one. The one in Japan,
Fukushima,
it got flooded. That was the problem. Don't build them when they're a flood zone. You look at that. I'm like, that is such a low hanging fruit of, okay, we need, because right now it's virtually impossible to open up a nuclear power plant in the United States. The regulatory framework is so anti-nuclear that you just can't build one. And if you were to build a bunch of them, then you could have more Teslas on the road. You could have more electric cars on the road, and you can reduce the fossil footprint, but neither of those are in there. I think they make a point in there that, let me see if I can find this. This is the FAQ section, Brian. Is nuclear a part of this? A Green New Deal is a massive investment in renewable energy production and would not include creating new nuclear plants. It's unclear if we will be able to decommission every nuclear plant within 10 years, but the plan is to transition off of nuclear and all fossil fuels as soon as possible. So we've taken the one thing we can do off the table. We're banking on a miracle. That's the plan, is just miracle. And also, key zone in on there, the word investment, because at no point in here is the word spending used. It's just investing our money for us. And in fact, it goes on at one point to talk about, this is just more catnip for me.
can't stop yourself. It's amazing.
I'm just reading this, and it's like, I'm just going, how, what? It said, hold on, I can't find the exact quote. But it basically says, look, this isn't a spending problem, because this is going to invest in and create an economic miracle. We need to be concerned about how to spend all of the money it's going to generate. That's the issue. And I'm going, wait, what?
So you're saying the Mexicans will pay for the wall? That's,
yes,
amazing.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And that is a recurrent feature of this entire thing, is another FAQ. How are we going to pay for this? Let me see if I can find that one. Let's see. 92.
While you're looking that up, one of the things that I wish people were more aware of is just how quick humanity is naturally decarbonizing. You know, when we were burning wood and hay, we had 10 carbon molecules for every hydrogen in there. Then you move to petroleum, you have 2 carbon molecules for every hydrogen. Then you go to methane or to natural gas, you have 1 carbon for every 4 hydrogen. We're like... politicians have a strong desire to legislate that which is happening anyway.
Right.
It's very clear.
Run ahead of the crowd with the clipboard world, and take credit for it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very clear that the world has an appetite for going clean, and we don't mind spending more money for it. And we don't mind investing on premium energy sources to get it. And it's already happening. It's as though we see the iceberg, and obviously the Titanic doesn't turn on a dime, but it takes a lot of time. And the question is like, no, we gotta push harder to the left. It's like, you can't push any harder than we already are. At least not without substituting or jeopardizing inherent freedoms and, I don't know, nuking the economy.
Right, so which is a key thing. And that, like, that the argument that is – the counter-argument that's being proposed constantly, or the good one-liner that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez had a couple of weeks ago is I'm more or less quoting this, but she said, the world is going to end in 12 years, and you're worried about how to pay for this. Good, succinct argument right there. But my response to that is I think that solutions to climate change are far more likely to come out of private sector innovation than they are out of public directed research. And I say that for two reasons. One, public directed research by nature is incredibly incremental. because if you just give a if you give the National Institute of Science or whatever a check for $1 billion and they blow it on weird stuff, all of them are going to get dragged in front of Congress. So what they're naturally going to do is they're going to go towards very, very minimal, incremental, steady progress in a particular realm, which is to say no out-of-the-box thinking or very limited out-of-the-box thinking. That's probably going to come from the private sector. And then there's also a lot of things that happen where it's completely unexpected. And a great example of that is USB cards, which were developed by, I believe, an Israeli defense firm. But they weren't developed to save trees. However, they have. In fact, USB cards have probably saved more trees than every Arbor Day combined over the last 50 years. And that was something where somebody was looking to make a buck, and they came up with that. And when we get into the broader economy, I think where this actually implemented, I think you would absolutely obliterate the American economy and probably obliterate the world economy, because we'll get into the costs in a minute. They are staggering. And the concern I have with that, in addition to not wanting the economy to tank, if you're only looking at this from a climate change is a problem perspective, you need to have the economy working to pay for all of this, but you also need it because that's where solutions are going to come out of. One of the things that's mentioned in the resolution itself, it says that, whereas the IPCC, the Intergovernmental, I can't remember what it stands for, but the big climate change committee, whereas they've determined that climate change is happening and human activity is a dominant factor and it has to be curbed within X amount of time. Using their same numbers, the IPCC numbers, the reason that those are lurching upwards in terms of carbon, or why they have been the last few years, even though you point out we're declining rapidly in carbon, is because the second and third world have been getting better, and they are projected to get better. Actually, most of the climate change models are predicated on carbon footprint increasing precisely because places like Ghana and Nigeria are going to industrialize instead of being in abject poverty. Now, aside from the humanitarian element of I don't want other fellow humans to live in abject poverty, I also look at that and go, there's got to be millions of Steve Jobs who are currently shoveling cow dung into a hut somewhere in Africa or Asia, and I want to unlock their brains and get them in on this. And if the economy implodes, they can't do that.
This is the Julian Simon thought. Julian Simon, the economist who famously took down Paul Ehrlich in a bet. Paul Ehrlich was claiming there'd be famine and disease, mm-hmm. and the world would be dead by 1980. And Julian Simon said, look, of all the natural assets out there, the most valuable one is human intelligence, because the more humans you have, the faster and better and more efficient problems get solved. In fact, name any bunch of elements or commodities, including oil, and I'll bet that in 10 years, the price is lower on the average. And sure enough, that was exactly the case, and they made that $10,000 bet. I'm a big believer that there's no more precious resource than human ingenuity. And weirdly, like, if you want to get this anarcho-capitalist libertarian get a little misty-eyed over the prospect of UBI, then, just talk to me about how much mind share would be unlocked by people who are currently worried about making, $10 an hour when they could be worried about, how to create a more efficient cold chain for milk supplies.
Yeah, the Ehrlich Simon debate is a fascinating one too. It's also interesting to look at. I did a little bit of a deep dive on that. Ehrlich, who is the doomsday prophet, there was a rock star in the 70s and 80s. Which, by the way,
he had been on the Tonight Show. He had been on the Tonight Show like 12 times.
Oh yeah, he was on it all the time. Johnny Carson loved that guy. And if you're witty and charismatic and you're telling everybody that the apocalypse is coming, people pay attention to you because you sound like you are a morally serious person. If you are an optimist like me and Brian, you sound like you're trying to sell life insurance, and you come off as a salesman. And for that reason, you're unlikely to see John Tierney, who I'm friends with, and he's a science writer for the New York Times, and tends to be wildly optimistic about basically everything. He's going to get awards from folks like the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He's probably not going to get invited on the Tonight Show to talk about how awesome everything is. Maybe Steven Pinker. He might be the only one doing that. But you could make a pretty good living being a doomsday prophet. And it got disproved. As you point out, Simon basically was like, pick something. And I think he picked tungsten or something like that. And
it was a spread of a whole bunch of them, and not only did the prices go down, but they went down in real dollars, not just adjusted for inflation dollars.
Yeah. So I did find how we're going to pay for the cost of this.
Okay.
So it says, how will you pay for it? the same way we paid for the New Deal, the 2008 bank bailout, and extensive quantitative easing programs, the same way we paid for World War II.
You're going to print money?
And all our current wars, yes. The Federal Reserve can extend credit to power these projects and investments, and new public banks can be created to extend credit. There is also a space for the government to take an equity stake in projects to get a return on investment. At the end of the day, this is an investment in our economy that should grow our wealth as a nation. So the question isn't how we will pay for it, but what we will do with our new shared prosperity. So yes, print money is the answer.
Put it on the card.
Yeah,
what's the big deal?
It's a print money type thing. And about two paragraphs before that, they say, why do we need a sweeping Green New Deal investment program? Why can't we just rely on regulations and taxes and the private sector to invest alone such a carbon tax or a fossil fuel ban? The level of investment required is massive. Even if every billionaire and company came together and were willing to pour all of their resources at their disposal into this investment, the aggregate value of the investments they could make would not be sufficient. So in other words, there is not enough wealth in America to pay for all of this stuff. So the solution is for the government to print money, because that is how you make wealth. Wealth is just an arbitrary. I'm going to get a nosebleed, Brian. I'm reading this going, does anyone, don't you have a degree in finance?
If you're reeling and getting woozy, this is the knockout punch that's going to send you into a coma, because you somehow skipped over my favorite sentence. Quote, upgrading all existing buildings in the United States.
Yes.
and building new buildings to achieve maximal energy efficiency, water efficiency, safety, affordability, comfort, and durability, including through electrification. Oh, good God. Just put it on the card.
Yeah. And then she does come clear on that she did an interview with Business Insider where she brought up monetary theory, but basically, was like, yeah, we would just print money. That's the long and the short of it. And if folks at home haven't heard me and Brian just rant about economics sufficiently yet, inflation doesn't create value. Inflation is pretty much only useful, from what I can tell, if you are trying to scam another entity out of paying them back for some amount of money you owe them, because you can inflate away value. And in fact, that's what's happening. If you double the amount of bills in circulation, all of those bills are worth half of what they were because there's more bills in circulation, right? So if you're the Weimar Republic and you've got to pay back France, you can basically screw them out of money by inflating away your currency and then paying them whatever the established amount was. Now, in the process, you also make all of the currency worthless. So anybody that saved money, they just lose it. It's gone. It's basically taxation without legislation. That's what inflation is. At no point, though, does it actually create wealth or create value. So you can't pay for all of this stuff doing it if there's not enough wealth already in existence to pay for it. Does that make sense, Brian? Am I getting that right?
Yes.
I'm getting into like shock jock mode where I'm just reeling at the insanity of a situation, which I wanted to avoid in general of this podcast.
This is where we bring it back to sanity. We remind ourselves, nobody on the right should believe any of this because this is trolling. Nobody on the left does believe this. This is all them wishing and high fiving each other, because also keep in mind, this comes after, Democrats take control of Congress. And then, now's the time. It's like, hey, man, what's a cool victory lap for us to do? None of this is serious. Nobody means any of this. And also, while I'm thinking about it, somebody out there will probably correct me on the Julian Simon Paul Ehrlich bet. It is true that had a different 10-year period happened to be picked, the bet wouldn't have been won. But the story's too precious to not share.
Overall, though, it is correct, because the overall thesis to it is that we don't run out of resources, because the more valuable resources become, the more innovative people get at figuring out a way to sell them, which is why we're not running out of oil, despite having been worried about running out of oil since the 70s. We will almost certainly, and this is another thing with the environment, very few people that I'm aware of want to or think we will remain on fossil fuels, by 2050. When we get off of them, it's probably not going to be by fiat. It's going to be because we innovated our way out of it. We didn't quit the Stone Age because we ran out of stones. We quit the Stone Age because we came up with a bunch of technology that progressed us out of it.
Yeah, you ready for a mind blower? I read this and I thought that cannot be true. And I spent like 30 minutes Googling and couldn't find a counterexample. But humanity has never, ever, ever run out of a single non-renewable resource. we've never run out. Because what happens is as we start to run out of it, we find alternatives, we raise the price on it. However, we have the only resources that we've lost forever have been renewable resources, like dodo birds.
Right, okay. I was about to say, because biodiversity is a thing, and we are losing biodiversity. That is a worthwhile conversation to have. And that is one of the few elements of this bill where I was like, okay, because they do bring up biodiversity. However, I do we should hit up a few of the other things that the bill, because we basically went into the grab bag of socialist policies and progressive wish list stuff that they'd like to do. You brought up that the bill would revamp every single building in the United States, no small order. That in and of itself would cost a lot of money. Some of the other things that they're looking to do, let's see. They would build a high-speed rail at a scale where air travel stops being necessary. That's in there.
Oh, boy.
So, okay, so there's one of my critiques with this would be, there are these places, for example, Hawaii or Puerto Rico, where you can't build a maybe to Puerto Rico. I'm not really sure the geography there. It would be very difficult to build a rail to Hawaii. Presumably the response would be, well, we could use boats, which would take a long time. But even if you're not worried about the speed of this, which is definitely a factor, because if you're taking a high speed rail from Los Angeles to New York, even if let's say theoretically there was a strip of land that was big enough to accommodate a high speed rail all the way between LA and New York that, you know, didn't require buying it out or eminent domain, it's just there somehow. I would think that even at a high speed rate, that would still take you a day or two to get from one to the other. So the speed element's there, but more importantly, the sheer mind-boggling amount of infrastructure that would need to go into that would not be worth it to have high-speed rail equipping everything. So, for example, in this proposal, we're getting rid of airports is what we're talking about. Airports don't exist anymore. We don't need them because we don't have fossil fuel, right? We're using electric-powered non-nuclear trains as a way to get around. Okay, so let's say that you are in Wyoming. What's the biggest city in Wyoming?
Casper.
Okay. Wyoming doesn't have enough people in it to. They have an at-large congressman or congresswoman. They don't even have like that. That means that they've got less than 850,000 people, right? So you're going to have towns right now or cities right now that are serviceable by airport that really don't merit having a high-speed rail between them. It would not make a whole lot of sense to, you know, Giles County, Iowa, to have a high-speed rail in it when it could have a regional airport at the moment that would do things. So the sheer amount of that, to put this in perspective here, were you to try and build a high-speed rail between Dallas and Houston, that would cost about $20 billion. That's within the state of Texas, between Dallas and Houston, $20 billion. Were you to just do the rail element of this bill for the entire United States, it would be in the trillions of dollars. It would be upwards of at least $1 trillion, probably quite a lot more. And at that point, I'm like, well, if we're that worried, wouldn't it be better to put that money in something else? Like, wouldn't it be better to, you know, try and get into carbon capturing, or alternately just give everybody USB cards? There's got to be better ways to spend the money to combat global warming than a $1 trillion high-speed rail to Casper, Wyoming.
Meanwhile, you know, SpaceX is announcing plans to allow you to take a rocket ship to Japan in 15 minutes on a BFR spaceship that runs on methane, a relatively low carbon fuel. I don't believe any of this. Not only do I not believe any of this, I don't believe that they believe any of this. Yeah. I am certain of that.
Yeah. A quick shout out. Two of the things in there that I agreed with. It said we're going to protect biodiversity. Okay. I would like to protect by. I'm with you, and clean up existing hazardous waste. All right, that sounds good to me. I'm fine with if there were bills that were if you wanted to get a bill to try and clean up Superfund sites, I think I'd get behind that. I think there's a way to do that. But that would be after the grab bag of massive government spending plus building a $1 trillion high speed rail to Casper, Wyoming, plus revamping every single building in the United States for state of the art energy efficiency and all of that. And then to get into the cost of this, which, again, we're going to pay for by printing money. The answer to this, I think if you were to actually sit down, I think the honest answer is we're going to get money from wherever money comes from, because clearly no one's thought about that. So to build, let's say, just the electric grid size of this. You would need 335 onshore wind turbines, 335,000 wind turbines onshore, 154,000 offshore, 75 million residential photovoltaic systems, 2.75 million commercial voltaic systems, 46,000 utility scale photovoltaic facilities, and 3,600 concentrated solar power facilities with on-site heat storage. So a lot. And
10 years, Mexico will pay for it.
10 years for all of that. Just to run it. This is not to build it. Just to run the electricity would cost about $7 trillion by 2030. And then the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation calculated the total cost of an earlier version of a similar scheme would cost about $13 trillion. So it's $13 trillion for building the electric grid infrastructure, another $7 trillion to run it. So we're up to $20 trillion by 2030, plus the, let's call it $2 trillion to put in all the high-speed rails, so up to $22 trillion, plus revamping every building in the United States.
Listen. Once we get this big, beautiful grid built, we're going to be winning so hard, you're going to get tired of winning. It's amazing.
You're right. I will get tired of it. So, all right.
I actually would love to see kind of a one-for-one tracking of all the things AOC says and how really it's the exact same play that Trump is making. I think there's like a mirror image. She's a Sinestro to his Green Lantern, or vice versa.
There's a fair amount of overlap there, and I might go ahead and conclude it there for fear that I'm going to have some kind of health wreck if I continue working my way through this. Just because
I don't often hear you get this riled up, man.
The thing is, Brian, what really irritates me are logical inconsistencies. Those are the things that really bug me. And so if I'm having a conversation with someone that I disagree with them, but they've got the building blocks of their argument themselves are coherent, and I'm going, you know what? The framework that you're assembling with those arguments, the solution that you have, X plus Y equals Z, I disagree with the Z. I enjoy those kind of things. But when it's just, X plus insert magical color equals Z, that kind of stuff drives me berserk. And so this is just, this might have purely been designed to elevate my blood pressure, because it's such a spadge-cocked, piffledygook policy that there's really nothing meaty for me to actually try and get into. And I tried. I had my producer, try and steel man this. I wanted to go in and be like, okay, well, and it's not. It's just posturing.
Well, again, the real goal of this was to get your goat, and they got your
they
goat.
They did it. They won. You won this round, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. You got me. Good job. All right. Well, Brian, I'll end it there. Thank you very much. Thank you for being the living and delightful blood thinner that I needed. You're far healthier than the amount of scotch I otherwise would have consumed to get through this. So thank you for that. I appreciate you coming on.
You got it, man.
Okay. All right. Pull it together, Heaton. And now for something completely different. Cooking with Heaton. All right, gang. A few of you have written in asking me, hey, Heaton, what's an easy, delicious meal I can make at home? It's a weird question for me, but you know what? I'll venture forth. The good news is there are plenty of quick, tasty dinners you can prepare in your kitchen, even if you don't have a green thumb like me. Today, I'm going to walk you through how to make a meatloaf. Start out with 2 cups of ground beef. The higher the fat content, the better. Now mix it into a large bowl. Pretty easy so far, right? Add an egg, some ketchup, and some Worcester sauce. It's spelled Worcestershire sauce, but it's pronounced Worcester. So the more Worcester sauce you add, the more English your meatloaf will taste. Little tip. Next, toss in some garlic powder, some dried breadcrumbs, some salt and pepper, and a bit of dried parsley, and then mix them all together. Now get out some onions and dice them. Little PSA here. Make sure your knife is very sharp. Kitchen accidents are more likely to occur with dull knives than sharp knives because the knife slips. That's true. Also, if you nick yourself, have some Band-Aids on hand to make sure you don't get any blood on your meatloaf, because that's gross. If you get some blood on your cuff sleeve or your shirt, be sure to use cold water to get it out. If you use hot water, that's going to set the blood, and then you can't get the stain out. Now, let's say there's a lot of blood, like 2 or 3 gallons of blood, and it just starts spraying across the walls. First, you're going to want to wipe that down with cold, soapy water. But that's just visual. Investigators can and will apply luminol to a crime scene, which reacts with blood found in hemoglobin. So clearly, a mop job isn't going to be enough. What you want to do is add 3 coats of paint. With 2 coats of paint, there's still a decent chance that investigators can use infrared sensors to spot some of the initial handprints peeking through. So put down 2 coats of white acrylic paint, which will interfere with the infrared sensor. Then finish the job with a coat of something like Mars Brown, because that particular paint uses an iron oxide-based pigment, which will help obscure the iron in the leftover hemoglobins. When you're done cutting onions, mix them into the mixing bowl, pour it flat into a loaf pan, and spread some ketchup on top. If you want to get fancy? Maybe add a little bit of brown sugar. Now bake it for 1 hour at 375 degrees, let it cool, and you've got yourself a pretty good meatloaf. In celebration of Abraham Lincoln's birthday, Mercury One is announcing its forthcoming special exhibition, which will be opening this summer. Tonight, from Mercury Studios, Mercury One will be posting live coverage of the kickoff party on their Facebook and Instagram pages. That's facebook.com/MercuryOneCharity and at Mercury One Charity. 12 score and 3 years ago, The Unfinished Promise of Unity opens June 28th and runs through July 7th. This exhibition covers slavery and freedom in an eye-opening way. Mercury One is collaborating with the African American Museum, the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, the Frontiers of Flight Museum, the Dallas Historical Society, the Old Red Museum, and others to feature some incredible artifacts. Audiences will have a chance to experience this incredible era in history, meet Black heroes and innovators that changed history, hear inspiring stories from the American journey, and leave equipped to be an agent of change, a modern abolitionist in your own community. VIP and general admission tickets are available now at mercuryone.org. I will be there tonight if you're going to be there. Or you can call 972-499-4747. And if you're not in Dallas, check it out on The Blaze. All right, a little bit of listener feedback before we go. This is on iTunes, where I always appreciate getting feedback. A review from Yo Mama! Exclamation mark. That is the name. I don't know whether this is actually your mother or not. It could be, however. Yo Mama writes, "Come gather round and listen to Andrew Heaton and his large stable of comedian friends, professional smart people, and intelligent, well-read laymen talk about literally everything interesting. And Andrew Heaton's borderline creepy obsession with Natalie Portman." What? "Perfectly timed for Mr. Heaton's door-to-door daily commute, a great way to spend your drive home from work. Thank you very much. I appreciate that tremendously. And if you have not rated and reviewed the show yet..." Why haven't you rated and reviewed the show yet on iTunes? I rated and reviewed your podcast. It seems like you should do that for me. Remember, you can always tweet me at Mighty Heaton or Facebook me at facebook.com/MightyHeaton or even email me by subscribing to my newsletter at MightyHeaton.com and just replying when I send it out on Fridays. I'd also like to encourage you to subscribe to Blaze TV and download the Blaze TV app. If you do, you can watch me instead of just listening to me. Use the promo code Heaton, my surname, to get $10 off your annual Blaze TV subscription. I look like Rob Cantor, minus the musical abilities. So download Blaze TV app on iTunes or Google Play, get subscribed to The Blaze, and then fall in love with me more than you already are. You can also watch portions of the show on Facebook Watch by going to facebook.com/HeatonTV. Tell me how my waistcoat game's going. Finally, please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Like I told you to earlier, hopefully you paused the podcast and did that, and this is redundant now, but if not, go do that. That helps other people discover this here political orphanage. Thank you, and good day.